Saturday Night Live, Friday Night Speaker Meeting, held at El Paseo Shopping Center, Room 120, in San Jose, California, on July 24th, 1992. Tonight's timid speaker is Blaine, and the main speaker is Leslie. The original recording and its copy are at the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes, and please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any A member at the public level.
My name is Blaine, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And you know, I'm clean and sober, clean and sober, by the grace of God, and only by the grace of God. And any success I am having is far more His than mine. You know, I talked to Ron just before the meeting. He says, "Hey, you want to try to keep about 10 minutes?" You know, I said, "Don't worry about that. I'm gonna keep 10 minutes because for me, this is a spiritual exercise for me." See, because if I can talk 10 minutes, that means that I can, you know, at least reduce one of my problems when I came in here, which is my self-centeredness. And if I can do that, then God can have another success, which is far more His than mine. So, you know, I'd like to share my experience, strength, and hope. And my experience, strength, and hope here is basically that, you know, I saw a gentleman stand up, and one of the things he keeps doing and what I kept doing for 9 years, because it took me that long to get 1 year in this program, is I kept coming back. And I just kept coming back. And I just kept coming back over and over and over and over and over again. I kept coming back. And, you know, and people would come to me and they would stay here and they would say to me, "How do you do that? How do you do that?" And I go, "How do you stay here?" You know, and that's how it was, you know. You know what? You know, I finally heard the message because I kept coming back, and I believe that I had to do that one because each time I came back, see, that leveled my pride just a little bit more and got me a little closer to humility. Now, I don't know what that is, but I know my pride got leveled, and I know when my pride gets leveled, I get a little humility. You know, you can't get your pride leveled without getting a little humility. And that happened to me. And I started to hear some things around here, and some of the things scared me. You know, like they said, you only have to change one thing around here, and that's everything. And I said, "Oh, my God." And they said, if you just don't take the first drink, you won't get loaded or you won't get drunk. And I couldn't hear that. But see, I didn't hear the whole entire message, because the whole entire message is that if you get yourself a sponsor and you work the 12 steps, you will find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. And you won't want to take nothing. You won't want to take nothing, no matter what. And I said, "Whoa, okay." You know, and they told me 90 meetings in 90 days, and I tried 90 meetings in 90 days. That never worked. The guys I work with today, I tell them, I said, "Look, I tell you what, I'll make you a bet. I'll make you a deal. You work the 12 steps, go to meetings, and don't take nothing. And if at the end of the 12 steps you want to take something, I'll get it for you." See, because I know he ain't going to take nothing. See, I came around here, and I saw a 44 questionnaire around, and it had so many questions, it just confused me. But the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous asked two questions. It said, if when you honestly want to, you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking or using, you cannot control the amount that you take, then you're probably an alcoholic or an addict. You know, and they started to talk to me, and they said, "Blaine, you know what you got? You got a twofold disease. You suffer from a hopeless state of mind and body. So you have a physical allergy. It's as real as a person is allergic to strawberries or fish or whatever. You have a physical allergy. You don't break out in bumps and rashes, but what you do break out is when you take that first one, when you take that first drink or that first drug, you break out into a rash of craving. Your body physically craves this thing. So bottom line is you have a physical allergy. You have a mind. You have a body that will not let you use successfully. See, there's a lot of things I can't do. Today I realize I can't use or drink successfully. You know, there's some other things I can't do. Like I can't get on top of this building and jump off on my head successfully. See, but unlike the disease of alcoholism, I don't have no obsession to get up on this roof and jump off on my head. See, I don't have that. Because that's what they told me. They said, "Blaine, you also got a mental obsession. You've got a mind that will not let you quit. You know what? That ain't your problem." I said, "Oh, shit." They said, "The bottom line, your problem is lack of power. That's your problem. See, because no human power is going to relieve you of that obsession. And you will always have the allergy, because we all know that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. So the main problem with you is in your mind. And if you work these 12 steps, you will find a power that will restore your sanity. Will restore your sanity and lift the obsession. And that's exactly what happened to me when I finally took all 12 steps. See? And I believe firmly to this day that steps, the first time through the steps, turn this power on. I believe the 10, 11, and 12, steps 10, 11, 12, turn this power up. See, when I got the sanity restored and the obsession was removed, I had three guys that came to visit me. There were two other guys who used to visit me when I used to use. I called them the demoralization brothers. You know, for one's pitiful and one's named incomprehensible. They come visit me all the time. They didn't fight their buddies, fear, shame, guilt, remorse, and they just party with my ass. The book said that, you know, lack of power, that was my dilemma. And I looked up dilemma and let me give you an analogy. A dilemma is when you're in between a rock and a hard place. That's a dilemma. That's a dilemma. And see, on one side I had an obsession, and on one side I had a physical allergy. You know, that's a dilemma. That's a dilemma. And see, the only thing that would pull me from that dilemma is a power greater than myself. Today, I love all steps, and I love all the steps, and I particularly love any step that I'm working on. But see, I got, like I said, those three guys came to visit me when the sanity was restored. I wasn't all crazy. I just was insane when it came to that idea. I'd always believe it. You know, so you can use this time. I go, oh, that's the truth. Okay. See? But now they don't visit me anymore. There's three other guys that visit me now. And they're called complacency, sloth, procrastination, and one's called laurels. I like to rest on him. And when I rest on him, I get real weird. See? But I found out something. I found out that in that 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these, and to try to practice these principles in all our affairs. And I asked them, I said, wait a minute, what? They don't say steps. What are the principles? And somebody finally, I asked it long enough. You know, if you ask a question long enough, somebody will tell you. And they told me what the principles were. And I said, well, wait a minute. Now, if I practice these principles in all my affairs, then let me look at something. Now, that means that any problem, difficulty, adversity is really, and I found this out, a spiritual opportunity. It's just in nasty packaging. You know, problem, difficulty, adversity. And so I said, well, I'm going to try this stuff, you know, because I'm going to try these principles. And so when they executed Harris, I got all really emotionally all messed up about that. And when I saw a two-hour documentary on the JFK assassination, and I found out some other people higher up that really were responsible for that, and that caused me some more emotional turmoil. And when Rodney King, when the jurors came back with their verdict, that caused me some more turmoil, and I said, well, this could be an affair. Because I was emotionally messed up. And so I went to that first principle, which is honesty. And I got honest, and I said, I want to get honest. You know, I want to practice that principle of honesty. So I went to the first step, and I said, boy, what is it that I'm powerless over? And I said, I'm powerless over those people that are responsible for Harris' assassination. I'm powerless over those people that are ultimately responsible for the JFK assassination. And I'm powerless over those people who brought back that verdict into Rodney King. I am powerless over that. And my refusal to admit that is why my life is right now unmanageable. And I felt some serenity come in, you know. I said, this is good stuff. So I went on to that second principle, and the second principle was hope. And I asked myself, Blaine, do you need some hope? I said, boy, you know I need some hope. So I looked at the second step behind that principle of hope, and it was came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, meaning that I am insane right now. And I just acknowledged that. And I said, woo, I got a little bit more of that serenity and peace. I said, well, this stuff's working. And I went on to the third principle, which is faith. And I said, do you need some faith? I said, boy, I need some faith. So I said, I made a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God. And all I simply did was turn my thoughts and my actions, because that's what my will and life are to me, my thoughts and actions. And I turned those over to the care of God relative to that situation. And I felt some more of that peace and some more of that serenity. I felt some power coming into my life. And I went on to the fourth principle, which is courage. And I said, Blaine, do you need some courage? Oh, I need some courage. I need some courage bad. And so I took a fourth step on that situation. I looked at my resentments and I looked at my fears and I looked at my sexual misconduct. I didn't do any of that. But I looked at it anyway. And I also looked at my wrongs, harms done to others, and it turned out I'd only wronged harm to me. And I looked at what was affected, and I looked at what were the causes, and you know, I looked at that, and then I got some courage. And then the fifth step is the principle is integrity. And I said, yeah, I need some integrity. I need some balance. I need some more consistency in my life because my life emotionally is not consistent. I'm not in balance. And so I did that one, and I shared all that stuff with another human being. And behind the sixth step, the sixth principle. Sixth principle is willingness. And I said, do you need willingness? I said, well, I need willingness. And so, you know what? I took that sixth step. You know, I took that sixth step. And I got that from that one. And the seventh step, the principle is humility. And so I asked God to, humbly asked God to remove the shortcomings. You know, humbly removed. And I felt a little bit more peace, a little bit more serenity. The eighth principle is brotherly love. And I asked myself, did I need brotherly love? And boy, did I need it. I needed brotherly love. Because I was hating some people. And I did that and I made a list. You know, I made a list of all people I'd harmed and made and became willing to make direct amends to them all. And the one that I hurt most was me. And I was on that list. And I didn't hurt anybody else. Just me. And the ninth step, the principle is justice. And boy, I wanted justice. Justice. So I made amends to me for what I did to me. And then I had to take that tenth step. And the tenth step, the principle is perseverance. And I needed some perseverance. And so every day, every time those thoughts would come back in my head, I just would take another inventory real quick and promptly admit when I was wrong. And the 11th step is spiritual awareness. And I needed spiritual awareness. So I did some prayer and I did some meditation. And I asked God for only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. And I got some more spirit. I know I got it. And guess what I had when I got to step 12? Step 12 is service. See, when I got to step 12, I had another spiritual awakening. Another one. And you know what? I looked back and I saw, you know, that garbage wrap, and I opened that thing up on the 12th step, and there I felt this serenity and this joy and this peace, and I felt a conscious contact with God. I felt an improved conscious contact with God. So I'm going to wrap this up by just saying simply that, you know, they said that the having had a spiritual awakening, and if you're new here, you don't know what that is, but see, we have this spiritual awakening, and that allows us to have a psychic change or personality change, tomatoes, tomatoes, and that allows us to have, how can I say this, that psychic change, that personality change that's essential to recovery. And that this is an ongoing process, and I had two problems when I came here. One was my alcohol and drug addiction, but the other one was my self-centeredness. So I'm going to sit down and say that, you know, thank you for allowing me to carry this message to you. And I'm going to sit down and end by saying, you know, welcome to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, where miracles happen all the time. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Leslie, and I'm an alcoholic. I like to say that out loud because for many, many years, I was the one person in my life that did not know that to be a fact. And it baffled the non-alcoholics around me that I couldn't get it, you know, that I was an alcoholic. And I really want to welcome the new people tonight because I hope that you get it like I got it by coming here. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was not a particularly different day than most of the days that had been happening for me for a long time. I woke up or came to or whatever I was doing at that moment, and I wasn't in jail. I did not have a wrecked car in the driveway or towed away. I had not lost a marriage or lover or family member that day or the day before. I could no longer work, so I hadn't lost a job. It really wasn't anything different than really any other day that was happening. It was just that I was different. And I think for one brief moment, God granted me a window of sanity through which I looked at my life as it really was, not as I perceived it or fantasized it or tried to make it look like it was happening, but as it really was. And I've got to tell you that I was pretty pitiful And that's exactly how I felt that morning. I felt pretty pitiful. And I did not know what to do with myself. I had tried a lot of different cures. I had tried a lot of different things in my life to try to cure the feeling that I had. And the only thing that cured it for any length of time was alcohol and drugs. That's the only thing that reliably cured it most of the time was alcohol and drugs. And it was that kind of feeling in the pit of my stomach of not fitting in, not belonging, inadequate, things weren't really going to happen, that kind of bafflement or mystery of people telling me that if you really wanted things and you went after them, things would happen for you, and that didn't happen for me. And I was kind of waiting around most of my life for whatever magic was going to happen that was going to make all of those feelings kind of go away permanently. Never realizing, of course, that might be Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you to know that. Never. And I started off, I guess, at rather a young age trying to fix it. And I found a couple of things that worked pretty good for a little time. Love works real good for about 6 weeks. I don't know if it works for anyone else. You know, wonderful feeling, absolutely marvelous feeling, guaranteed to distract you from absolutely everything nasty in your life. And for about 6 weeks, it's right there on the edge of just great. After that, with my kind of personality, it got to be real wretched, and so I would move on to the next six-week love, you know, ain't love grand. And so men for a long time was a big distraction, and that was pretty good at making me feel pretty good, and it worked real reliably for a while. Men with money worked even better. Usually, those people didn't last 6 weeks, I have to tell you that. With my kind of personality and my drinking and my using, those people lasted a shorter amount of time. They don't have as much tolerance and patience as men without money. So I went from men to men with money to men without money, and men without money were a lot more tolerant, but even men without money, after a while, didn't work. Not because I didn't want it to work, but because they were pretty intolerant of my behavior. And so men without money kind of left too. I tried a career, and that worked for a while. Great distraction, a career. Especially for a compulsive nature like myself, you can work 11 hours a day. You can work 7 days a week. You can really get a lot of places. Doesn't last. Just kind of like love. Grand feeling, right on the edge. I tried moving. I tried moving longer distances. I tried moving really long distances. I moved from California to New York City, and then I moved back. And that worked for a short amount of time, but nothing worked consistently like alcohol, really. I knew I was in trouble instantly with drugs, and only did that a relatively short amount of time because I kept ending up in jail, compliments of the County of Orange or the County of Los Angeles. And that hotel did not really, you know, strike my fancy. So I decided that was, obviously couldn't tolerate that. So just kind of went off to alcohol. Very portable substance, easy to acquire. Don't really have to have a lot of money. Don't have to be precious and darling. Don't have to look good. You can do it alone. You don't have to get up to go do it. You don't really even have to drive to go do it. And I ended up, after a long kind of struggle at life, moving to the country to get healthy and eating, I don't know, gravel and drinking only natural wines or something. I can't remember. But I was really on a search for something to replace the alcohol. It never occurred to me through all of this and the trials and tribulations around alcohol, I can't believe it to even say it, that I was an alcoholic. You know, it never occurred to me that alcohol was my problem. And I gave up things to drink and really at the expense of drinking. And I think that they might have been unconscious decisions, but it never occurred to me to stop drinking. I don't know if any of the rest of you find this, but I gave up, you know, things like working. Work is really not a thing an alcoholic can do, you know, who's progressed like I was progressing, certainly, because that meant you had to get up, get dressed, and go somewhere in some kind of shape. And I was incapable of that, so I just kind of, like, didn't go anymore. I don't know. And I don't remember saying, gee, I think I'll drink instead of going to work. I never thought that. I just thought, boy, this is really a drag. You know, so I'm not going to go anymore. Because the boss is nasty, or the work is nasty, or the hours are wrong, or the pay is lower, whatever excuse I could find. But at any rate, I could no longer really have any relationships. I mean, I'm not talking about friends and family. I'm really talking about lovers. Lovers kind of like left. And I started a string of 24-hour lovers, you know. And they got better looking as the day progressed and as my disease progressed through the day. And I'm sure I got better looking to them, too, God knows. And so there I was, you know, kind of doing love on a 24-hour basis. And that wasn't too exciting. And it was really bad when I couldn't remember their name. I'm bad with names anyway. It takes me a little while to get people's names. And 24 hours was just never really long enough. And after being drunk, the majority of it, I mean, I was so self-centered and self-involved anyway, the idea of having to try to find someone's name kind of in the recesses of my brain was beyond me. So it got a little touchy, and I started to feel a little strange about it. Not that I stopped, but I did feel a little strange about it. I decided at one point in time that I could no longer drive. This happened after an episode. For some reason, I was the kind of person, put a drink in me, I wanted to drive. I'm sure that happens to that didn't happen to anyone in this room. But it was getting to the point where most of the law enforcement in the areas that I resided kind of got to know me kind of well. And so I was the person who was going to go to jail a lot. And I did a lot go there. And I kept saying to myself, my goodness, I have to stop driving. Never occurred to me. And I tried a lot of different things. You know, I really did. I was a blackout drinker, which is really dangerous. And so I kind of thought that in my brain. I had it wired that if I couldn't remember what happened to me in the blackout, that when I was in the blackout, I couldn't remember what was happening to me when I wasn't in the blackout. So I used to hide the keys from myself. I'll just hide them behind these books, and then when I get in the blackout, I won't remember where they are. Well, obviously that didn't work too well. And one day I came to, and the car was still running. Now I have no idea whether I just like went out, started it, got bored, left it, whether I drove it somewhere, you know, and came home and just kind of missed the step. I don't know. But it was real hot. And so, of course, what did I say? I never even consciously gave it a thought, I should stop drinking. I said, well, I've got to quit driving. So I gave up the car. And the car got sold. And I drank the money, of course. So now I don't have a car. I don't have any lovers. My friends and my family had long since given up. It was way too painful for them to watch me crash my head into brick walls on a daily basis, so they gave it up. And I was pretty much by myself, and the bartender, the owner of the bar that I drank in, asked me if I wanted to move into the shack behind the bar. And I said, that sounds convenient. Never occurred to me that wasn't something that I really wanted to do. Nothing. And I had come from a place, my folks, neither one are alcoholic. Both are very well educated. They're both self-made people. They're both pretty successful. And I was really a disappointment. You know, I really was. In fact, I still hate the word potential. You know, don't you hate the word potential? I was always a child of potential. And that phrase was inevitably followed by, it's too bad. Because I never lived up to my potential. And I think that my folks being non-alcoholic were really confused by the nature of this illness, because they couldn't figure out, as I said earlier, why I didn't get it. And I'm not sure that I really understand why I didn't get it either, except that God just one day clicked that message on for me. But here I was living behind the bar, and when I first spoke, the very first time I spoke for an hour, I said to a friend of mine, because I was out of town, and I said, how do I explain to people the nature of this bar that I drank in? And this friend said to me, Leslie, just tell them that the name of the bar was Red's Recovery Room, and they'll get it, you know? And that's the kind of place that I drank. It was not a place that was, by any stretch of the imagination, a cocktail lounge. It really was a place for people like me to practice their disease. And we all went every day, most of the day, and practiced our disease. And it got to the point where I no longer felt comfortable in wet, slippery places, so I gave up bathing. Now, bathing is a very dangerous thing for an alcoholic. I don't know if any of you have experienced that, but bathing soap, slippery. You really have to be able to, you know, stand and balance. Well, I went down one day and I hit every, like, bone and appendage going down, and I ended up really black and blue. I looked like I had been beat up. And it wasn't as though that wasn't a normal state of affairs for me, but that day it happened from the shower. And so I just decided that I wasn't going to bathe anymore. Now, it never occurred to me to stop drinking. I just decided I was no longer going to bathe. And I didn't. And I never consciously, I don't consciously remember making that decision. It's just one day that I just kind of didn't do it, and the next day I just kind of didn't do it, and the next day I just kind of didn't do it, and I got dirty. And I got real dirty. Excuse me, and that morning that I woke up, that was the end for me of practicing that part of this illness. I woke up and I looked at my wrists here, and where the little lines and the cracks were in my wrists were white, and everything else was pretty dark. And I realized that I was dirty, and it was the first time I consciously noticed that about myself. And when I think of all of the other little things that I had given up, like, you know, Christmas. Well, I mean, my family had really had it with Christmas and me. Because, I mean, my father even took to wiring the tree up. Because I would, even early, I would inevitably get drunk, get maudlin, stand in front of the tree, start to cry, for what reason, I don't know, start to go, reach out, grab the tree, and me and the tree went down. Every year. My father took this real heavy line and wired the tree up. And finally, they just asked me not to come around much anymore. I mean, no one called and said, gee, what are you doing for Christmas? When my mother would call people, they'd say, is Leslie coming? And my mother would say, no, I haven't heard from her in months. I don't think so. I had come from a place where, in the career stage of my alcoholism, I worked in a fashion house in New York, and I was real elegantly attired. I had a clothing allowance, and we bought a lot on wholesale, or we were gifted a lot of merchandise, and I walked around looking real good. And by the time I got to Red's Recovery Room, I really was in one pair of jeans. And that was fine because the bikers I ran with were all in one pair of jeans too, and thought that that was really a sign of, you know, of having made it. It's when they kind of stood up in the corner, that was it. So I fit right in. But meanwhile, you know, on this morning that I was looking at my life as it really was, I was trying to figure out what I could possibly do to make a difference. And if I was going to do anything, what I would wear. you know. I mean, I don't know about you, but a lot of the times in my life when I'm going someplace that I'm really not sure of, I can't find something to wear. You know, no matter what it is, I have half of the closet out. It's on, it's off. It's, you know, it's too tight, it's too short, it's too long. The shoes don't work. The earrings, I can't find. You know, I was that kind of mood that day because I was frightened. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know how I was going to get out of this mess. But I knew one thing, and that was that you people didn't drink. And I have to tell you that that did not sound particularly inviting. You know, I just didn't know if I was really ready to give that up. But I was down to like two choices in my life. And they were commit suicide or go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really had to ponder, you know. And the only reason that AA won is because I could not decide how to do myself in that didn't require a tremendous amount of effort in the condition I was in. You know, because I was not feeling well. And, like, remember, I had sold the car. So the only way I could think of to do it, because if I'd had a gun, I'd have sold it. Okay, so there was nothing having anything of value. So I didn't have a gun because I would have sold it. I didn't have a car because I had already sold it. I didn't have enough pills to get together, because believe me, if I'd had enough pills to get together, I would have eaten them long before that. I mean, I would have never been able to get a collection big enough to kill me all at one time. I would have cheated, you know. Well, these are my suicide pills. I'll just have two or three. Just have two or three more. So, I mean, couldn't do that. So the dilemma was how to kill myself. I had had an uncle who had blown his head off with a gun. Really disgusting mess. I just have to tell you, a real disgusting mess. And I thought, my family thinks poor of me already. Can you imagine this? I mean, no. So I thought, no, that wouldn't work. Even if I could get a gun, that's not going to work. So the only thing I could think of was to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. I thought, okay, now that does sound workable. And all you have to do is, like, kind of climb over the railing and let go, and you've got it. But the thought of having to hitchhike from Sonoma County to the bridge in the condition I was in, and making, can you imagine, inane small talk with whomever would pick me up, was beyond me. I said, I can't do that. So we had to kind of go back to the table and think, okay, now, what can we do? Well, I guess we have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went into the bar and I made the call from the bar, which I thought was classic. And the owner was getting a little nervous. Just the word Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, you know, scares any kind of an owner or a bartender that works with people like us. They can just see the dollars floating out the door. And God forbid you might bring the message back, take several more out with you. But I remember this woman got on the phone with me. I don't remember a lot about what she said, but I said, you know, what all people who are in the condition that I was in that morning, I said, I want to stop drinking forever. And she didn't say anything like, because I mean, you have no idea how many times I had said that. Many, many, many times. I mean, I was like, and stopping was not a problem for me. I don't know about the rest of you. I could stop at will. It was staying stopped that was a problem, and sometimes it was 3 months, and sometimes it was 10 minutes. Stopping was not the problem. It was really staying stopped. So I picked up the phone, and I dialed Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told this woman I wanted to quit drinking forever. And she said, let me put you in touch with some people who feel like you feel. And I thought, okay. And so she told me I had to go to this meeting, and I knew a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, somebody had dragged me, totally unprovoked, had dragged me at one point many years before. So I had a vague idea of what you people were all about, I thought. And she said that there was a meeting close to me, because, of course, here I was hoofing it, remember. And if I could think about hitchhiking, I could have made it to the bridge. So there was no hitchhiking. I really had to walk. And she said that there was this community center with all these different rooms, and in one of the rooms at 7:30 that night, I would find a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. and I spent the rest of the day getting dressed. I could not decide what would be appropriate attire. I was so pitiful and so sick, I just didn't want you people to know how bad I felt. I wanted you to think I had it together a little bit. So I went searching through my stuff, the old stuff, the old-fashioned stuff, and I found stuff to put on. Now, I know I got in the shower. I know I attempted makeup, which is pretty frightening. And I walked. I was early, of course, and I like sort of sat over at the side and watched these people get out of their cars and go in. Finally, I went in. There was a whole lot of people, too. I think all these people can't be alcoholics. And besides, nobody looked like an alcoholic. I couldn't see anyone that looked like I visualized an alcoholic to look. So I sat there, and pretty soon I figured, gosh, you know, I better go in. So I walked down this community center, and there were all these different rooms, and there was stuff happening in all the rooms. Now, I could tell the Tai Chi, even in my state, I could tell the Tai Chi, I figured, nope, that's not it. And there was some kind of jazzercise or something going on in another room, and I said, no, that doesn't look like it. But then I kind of like walked up to this door, and the PTA was like meeting in there. So I started away, and this woman swept over to me, and she said, are you looking for Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought, how can she tell? Now, I don't believe them, but the people that were there that night when I walked in tell me that I only had one leg in the pantyhose. And the other was kind of like dragging. I like missed the other leg. And I must have been really frightening looking because everybody knew I was brand new. There was no question in anyone's mind. And I got sober in a real small little town, and there weren't a lot of newcomers in those days, and so I was like a uniqueness. They hadn't had one in 6 weeks. And they like descended on me en masse. They sat me down. They got me a half a cup of coffee. They took it away from me. And this woman sat down, and she was just real nice to me, and I could feel the love just coming out of her. I thought it was real lame at the time. I want you to know that. But she said to me, you know, why are you here, or something like that. And I proceeded to give her my standard I'm going to quit drinking line, which is that I want to quit drinking forever. I'm never going to have another drink. And she gave me my first piece of Alcoholics Anonymous. She said to me, we like to think about doing that one day at a time. I thought, dear, you don't understand. Never, ever, ever again. Not just for today. Forever. And she said, yes, we like to think of that as one day at a time, and we find it much easier. So I said, all right, whatever. Just, you know, leave me sit here. And I was trying not to get sick. You know, you can imagine, I hadn't had a drink all day. I was really trying not to get sick. And here was this woman. She looked like, I mean, she looked like she had never walked into a bar in her life, not the kind of bars I drank in. She looked like she got drunk by a Search for Tomorrow, you know, in front of the soaps. I mean, I was just, I was a little distressed, thinking there was no one really like me in the place. But I will tell you that something happened to me that night that was magic. And that was that I listened to you people talk to each other before the meeting happened. And you had stuff going on in your life. You had plans. It was in July. And you had plans for August or September or vacation. Saturday. You know, I could not make those kind of plans, and I never realized that until that night. I never realized what freedom you had, because I did not know what state I was going to be in on Saturday. And I do not mean condition. I mean like Oregon or Arizona or California. You know, I didn't know where or what was going to happen. And if I made plans, there was no way that I could guarantee that that was going to happen. So I just stopped making plans. Never occurred to me to quit drinking. I just stopped making plans. And I hadn't realized it till that night. And there was all of you people were standing around, you were talking about family and friends and jobs and stuff going on in your lives. You looked normal. You looked like I wanted to look at that moment. You felt like I wanted to feel. And even though I thought most of you were pretty lame, I've got to tell you, I thought to myself, wow, you know, if these people can do it, I mean, surely this great brain and body could do this. I call it insecure arrogance, you know, just arrogant for absolutely no reason at all. But I felt that magic that you people have that night. And God granted me that vision of what could happen to me if I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and stayed here. And pretty soon this woman walked in and she had this cake. And in the fellowship I grew up in, you brought your own cake for your birthday. And someone said, wow, is it your birthday? And I thought, well, she's got a birthday cake. Let's get a grip, you know. And she said, yes, it is my birthday. And they said, how old are you? And I thought, wow, how rude. You don't even have age or, gosh. And she said, 5. Now, even in my pitiful state of mind, I figured this woman was a little older than 5. And all of a sudden, it just crashed into my mind that this woman had been 5 years without a drink. I could not fathom it. I didn't know what did you do for a football game? What did you do on Fridays? How did you dance? What did you do for Christmas? This is in July now. How did you celebrate Christmas? New Year's Eve, weddings. What if I were to get married? Now, there was no one even close, okay, to asking me to marry them. But I thought, what do you do? How do you set champagne? I mean, it's normal, everyday stuff. And I was just awed. And I continued to be awed through the whole meeting. I remember clearly when they read the 5th chapter, like was read tonight, when they said, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, or the other phrase that I remember clearly was the path, you know, that path being outlined. Now, I didn't hear any of the steps, I can assure you, because if I'd have heard step 4, I'd have never come back. If I'd have heard step 5, I'd have shot out of there before the meeting was even over. So God granted me a little hearing loss around those kind of steps, but I just like was wall like behind me, and there was this big huge poster and it said alcoholism, the disease of loneliness. And I thought, wow, does that fit? That fits. And I felt that at a real core level of myself. And I wanted to come back, and you people were really nice to me. The women in the fellowship, and there weren't many, but the women in the fellowship went home with me on the excuse of driving me home and asked me to tell them my life story. And my favorite topic, of course, was myself. And really, most of the time still is today. I have to tell you, it hasn't improved all that much. But they sat there, and they sat there with me for days, I think, and listened to me tell my story. Now, I'm sure that they thought I was going to go into convulsions or have whatever horrible thing happen. They tried to get me to go to the county detox. I was having nothing to do with anywhere that locked its doors. You know, I had done enough jails, and I really felt, and I think one of the things that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous is I really felt as though if you people even knew what was going on in my brain, you were going to lock me up. And so I knew that if you got me into a place like that, it was all over. They'd just throw away the keys and that would be it. So these women just sat there, and I never even realized that, you know, I was just going on and on and on for days, I think. I don't know how long. And I kept going to meetings. They kept just taking me to meetings every day. I went to meetings and I didn't drink in between. And the most amazing things started to happen to me. Just absolutely amazing. There weren't a lot of women in the meetings, but there was this one And I would like to tell you that I like ran over to her and said, "Will you sponsor me?" That would be a total and complete lie. And I just can't even tell you that, even though I would like to tell you that that's how I worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Actually, what happened is I just went to meetings, you know, and I made friends with the men, of course, and stayed away from the women. And there was this one woman who sat along the wall, and she had these, like, little kind of reading glasses that sat on her nose that she looked over the top of. And she was real vicious looking. I could tell that she was one of those real vicious human beings. She looked over the top of them, and she would look at me, and I knew she was reading my mail. And she knitted throughout the meetings, or crocheted or something. I knitted. She knitted throughout the meeting. And I avoided her like the plague. In fact, if she was on one side of the meeting hall, I went around the table on the other side. Because I didn't even want to get anywhere near her. I knew it was going to, like, rub off of her or something, or arc, you know, between the two of us. I just was. And so I was around Alcoholics Anonymous. I was kind of around for a long time. I wasn't really a member. I was just around. I started to feel better. I moved out from behind the bar, and my father, God love him, he was such a sweet man, he came in and kind of rescued me, and he set me up in a little room, and he gave me a couple of months' rent. I think he felt sorry for me, to tell you the truth. And as long as I didn't drink, nice things happened to me, and I kept going to meetings, and I kept being attracted by you people, but I wasn't a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this woman kind of kept glaring at me from across the room. And one night, you know, I wasn't really an alcoholic until one night this woman was speaking, and she said that she was so obsessed with her alcohol that she actually took her glass or drink into the bathroom with her to put on her makeup. She just couldn't be, you know, without the drink even that long. And I thought, my God, I used to take mine in the shower, which is why I gave up bathing. And I was, for the very first time, I was, you know, she said that she was an alcoholic, and I was worse than somebody. And I heard that. And at that moment, I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I became an alcoholic. I don't know whether I bought that I couldn't drink anymore. But one day at a time, I didn't drink, and I came to meetings, and the woman across the meeting room glared at me. And finally, one day, she put her stuff down before the meeting, and she walked over, and I knew she was walking to me, and I almost peed in my pants, and she said to me, I was so frightened, "Do you have a sponsor yet?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, I'm your sponsor. Here's my phone number. Call me." And I went right home and called her. I was so frightened of her. And that woman, she had such great love and such great affection and such great spirit of this fellowship that she truly brought me into sobriety. She started me working the steps. She talked to me about the unmanageability of her life and how she had found step one in her own heart and in her own being, how she felt step one. And by sharing those things from her, I was able to feel those things myself, and I was able to manage to take step one. She talked to me about her higher power, and I talked to her about mine. I had done a lot of searching around for some kind of spiritual thinking, and at different times when I was quitting drinking, I had tried a lot of different things, some of them fundamentalist. And so I knew that from my behavior in life, that there was absolutely no way that God was going to be on my side, and that the ledger on my side was pretty red. And she shared with me that her God was a loving God that forgave and really helped. And once you turned towards that God really shined on you. And she said to me, "You know, if you'd like to borrow my higher power, you may." And I borrowed him and never gave him back. And I started to ask really on a daily basis for just sobriety today, just not to drink today. At one point in time, I got very angry with a situation that was in my life. I wasn't too sober. I think I was about, maybe 2.5 months or something. I was really angry. I thought I was going to have to drink. I called her. She came over. She talked to me for 2.5 hours. She saved my life. I didn't have to drink that day. And from that day, I got the experience that I didn't have to drink, that if I picked up the phone, my life was going to be saved, that God would allow me not to have to drink today. She talked to me about step three, about turning our lives and our will over to the care of God as we understood Him, or as we borrowed Him, in my case. And she talked to me about what letting go was all about, and about the idea and the concept that the managing of my life up until this point had been done solely and completely by me. And since I had done such a nice job of it, maybe it was time for me to turn that manage of my life and what I thought about managing my life over to God and see what results could possibly come. And she taught me to get down on my knees, and she told me there is absolutely no problem personally that cannot be solved by 2 weeks worth of getting down on your knees morning and night and asking for help. And many times I've done that. I've never had it fail me yet. And then I started to work step 3.5. Now, for those of you who may not know, step 3.5 is I am working 4. And I was working 4 for a long time. And finally she got aggravated with me one afternoon. She said to me, if you would go home, sit down, pencil, paper, you would find it to be much easier. Well, I was humiliated. It was in front of at least 2 people at a 15-yard distance. I'm sure they heard her. I said, I'll show her. I'll go home and work 4. So I did. Now, in those days, she didn't teach me to work 4, and my current sponsor has done a real nice job in sitting me down step by step by step and talking about the method of working steps that really work for me. But I had such garbage in my life, all I could do was just write it down. And I wrote it down. All these heinous things, all of this garbage, all the shame, all the misery, all the pitiful times in my life, all the things I had done wrong, all the manufactured and non-manufactured wrongs that I had done to other people, all the things that I knew people were looking at me and thinking, I know all about this one. And that incredible feeling, I guess, of shame that I felt behind my life and its history up to that point, I wrote it all down. I called her up. I have no idea whether she had other plans that day. She was gracious enough to say that she would hear my 5th step. I then put my 4th step in an envelope, marked it personal, private, to be destroyed if I die. And I got in the car and I drove over to her house. I was so frightened, you know, that I might die, and someone might find the envelope in the wreckage and open it and read it. Like, you know, someone would even be interested. But I was really self-involved, and I thought this was me. I got over there, and we sat down, and she had me read my 4th step to her. She did not look at all impressed. I want you to know that. She had been in this program a long time, and she had heard a lot of 4 steps. She then shared her stuff with me. I was really impressed. I could not feature this woman doing any of the things she was talking to me about. I was just in heaven. Keep going, I said. What else? I was just so impressed. She was practically yawning. I mean, my stuff was just not all that great. And then I burned my 4th step in her fireplace, almost setting her house on fire. And I guess at that moment, the true magic that is sobriety came over me. It doesn't always happen like that. I've heard a lot of 5th steps, and I have taken a lot myself. And sometimes that thing happens right away, and sometimes it takes a little while, but it always happens. And that is that for the very first time in my life, I felt clean, like the slate was wiped clean. Like I could write what I wanted on there. Like life was really a learning process. Like all the things that had happened to me up to that point brought me here to Alcoholics Anonymous, to come here to learn how to live. And that they were all valuable and all were something, and I have shared each and every one of those with somebody at some time in my sobriety to let them know that they're not the only one that had those kind of issues in their lives, and they have true value today. She sent me home to think about my life and to think about some of the twists in my life that I wanted to not live with anymore. She taught me how to get down on my knees and to ask God to remove those character defects, those twists that were making my life pretty miserable. We met, and I had a list of the people that I had harmed. She asked me to put myself at the top of the list, and I did. She and I role-played working to go to people and to make amends, and I did. And some of those people I've never seen, and I'm still waiting to even know where they are, and if it ever comes up, I'm going to make amends right away. And she taught me about consistency and spiritual consistency. She taught me about thinking about my life on a daily basis, moment to moment, and making the decisions moment to moment that were going to benefit me. She talked to me about what anonymity was all about and the difference between public anonymity and spiritual anonymity and giving back into this fellowship what I had given. She started to take me on 12-step calls. Now, then we didn't throw everybody in detox. You know, you kind of went out and talked to people. There wasn't a lot of recovery facilities, especially out in the boonies where I live. And so she would call me in the middle of the night, 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock, and she would say, "Be out on the curb in 5 minutes. All right? And she let me carry the big book. That was my assignment. And she let me know very clearly that I had nothing whatsoever to share except the big book and my smile. First time I went, she said, "Try to look sober." All right. I wasn't even insulted. That's how dense I was. So I would, like, pull on jeans and a T-shirt or something, and I would run out to the curb, and I would stand there, and she would whiz by, hit the brakes. I would jump in, and we would be off. I think I missed that camaraderie more than anything else with all the treatment facilities that we have. Yes, it brings more people to us, but I missed that in sharing that with the people that I sponsor today. Because there was a lot of 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. Denny's coffees after we had carried the message to someone who had decided that maybe they didn't want to hear the message after all. You know, as we get a little sober, sometimes we don't consider the time quite so crisis-y. And I missed that kind of camaraderie and that spiritual connection that we had. I have had a lot of opportunities for growth in my sobriety. I don't even consider them bad times anymore. I consider the fact that I don't really know what is or what isn't a bad time. The worst day of my life was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, turned out to be the best day. You know, those kinds of things. I've been fired in sobriety. I've lost my father to cancer in sobriety. I was very close to him. I started my own business in sobriety. I've gone broke. I've gone bankrupt. I have been asked for a divorce. I've been asked to get married and then asked for the divorce. I've had a lot of opportunities for growth, and every single one of them has made me feel better. Now, I know that that may sound strange to you, especially if you're new, but every one of them makes me feel better. I consider each one of them to be a real privilege to be able to walk through, a chance for God to show his omnipotence. And for those of you who don't know what omnipotence means, and I certainly didn't, so I had to go look it up. My sponsor made me go look it up. It means, you know, the God working in your life. It's really been a chance for God to show me his omnipotence and to take me in a direction that is better than where I've been. I always feel hope here. I feel that God has granted me hope. Sometimes I have twists of despair, but it's only when I'm turning away from the truth, when I don't want to see myself in the truth, when I don't want to work steps, when I don't want to do something, when I get that little kind of spoiled child, no, I don't want to give that up. You can take all of those, but these I get to keep. And sooner or later, I start shedding those, and then there's a whole bunch of new ones, you know, that I start to shed. Life for me today is so exciting. Today, people actually trust me with hundreds of thousands of their dollars. I don't know why. They don't know anything about me, and they still trust me. They meet me, and they think, okay, this woman looks, you know, trustworthy. They don't know anything about me, and they still trust me. And for good reason, because I don't steal their money. I don't even dip into it, not even a little. I don't cheat them. I mean, it's amazing. I have personal ethics today. I have personal principles today. I usually don't have 24-hour love affairs. I mean, I usually know the people that I'm either sleeping with or even eating with. I don't miss a drink. I can't tell you. I think the greatest thing that I can tell you if you're new tonight, and the greatest hope is that if there was a drug today that I could take that would allow me to drink normally, I wouldn't even bother. It's just not even something I even desire. And I never thought I would be able to say that, ever. God has granted me freedom from that one day at a time, as long as I participate within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to end tonight by reading you my favorite two little paragraphs right out of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new and you don't have this book, you really should get it. It is our textbook. I hated that when people used to say that this is our textbook. I thought, oh God, more learning. Didn't like it in school. Don't want it now. And I really carried it around for a long time. I would carry it. It's kind of like step 3.5. I'm reading the book. Never cracked it. This is from chapter 11. It's the chapter title is A Vision for You, and it talks about what happens after you get sober within Alcoholics Anonymous, what's ahead for you. And it says, we have shown how we got out from under. You say, yes, I am willing, but am I consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus, we find the fellowship, and so will you. Thank you, everybody, for having me. This has been a real treat for me.